This morning, power from Romans 13. We looked last week at an introduction of this of these seven verses. I think it was simple, it was clear. The text is challenging for sure. But dealing with life in a fallen world is always challenging. We should never imagine it's easy. Paul in chapter 12 points us to something that we can easily take for granted. And this chapter, verse 7, demands that you not take it for granted. Verses 1 through 7. The thing that Paul points to in Romans 12 at the end that you must not take for granted and then jump into these seven verses is the reality of evil. If you'll look again at Romans 12, 17, Paul said, "Never pay back evil for evil to anyone." And then he said in verse 21, "Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." In order to instruct Christians how to react to evil, demands that there be evil. Evil is real. Evil is a thing. I don't mean by that a person, though it is personified oftentimes. And if evil is a thing, then good needs to be a thing. And Paul puts those two together in verse 21. Don't be overcome by evil, overcome evil with good. So we have two things. We have evil and we have good. Some have said without evil, good couldn't be. Without evil, good couldn't be. I don't accept that. I don't think you can say that and be biblically honest. Because God is good. And He is good with no relation to evil. His goodness does not require evil at all. He is intrinsically and essentially good. However, I do think the opposite of that statement, which isn't true, is true. Without good, there could be no evil. True good, absolute good, a standard of good, is required for there to be evil and to have it identified as such. But there are always those two things, good and evil, and Paul reminds us of that at the end of chapter 12. He reminds Christians that we, in the pursuit of good, will come in constant conflict with evil. There's no avoiding it. The only thing you can control is how you react to it. And he reminds us how to react to it. And he tells us how not to react to it. When you are confronted or you intersect with evil, those of us in the pursuit of good. So now with that, having not now been overlooked, the reality of good and evil, he turns to seven verses at the beginning of chapter 13 that require that understanding in order that you would understand these seven verses. Let's read them again. We read them last week. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority has opposed the ordinance of God, and they who have opposed will receive condemnation upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of authority? Do what is good, and you will have praise from the same. For it is a minister of God to you for good. But if you do what is evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing. For it is a minister of God, an avenger, who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. Therefore it is necessary to be in subjection, not only because of wrath, but also for conscience sake. For because of this you also pay taxes, for rulers are servants of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Render to all what is due them, tax to whom tax is due, custom to whom custom, fear to whom fear, honor to whom honor. We said last week there's really only two principles here. Be subject to or submit and pay your taxes. Those two principles are there. There's additional words added for our understanding, but those are the two principles that must at least be there if you were to understand what Paul wrote. These verses are hard for Christians. We acknowledged that last week. We acknowledge it again this week. We acknowledged it in 2020 during COVID. We had lots of opportunity as Christians in the Christian church to acknowledge the difficulty of these verses. They are a battleground in the church. Not all Christians agree with what Paul is teaching here. Some have gone so far as to suggest these seven verses really don't even belong here. Some have suggested Paul didn't write these seven verses. They point out that at the end of chapter 12, you have this statement which most naturally continues with the beginning of verse 8 of chapter 13. Just look at it. You can read it this way. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For he who loves his neighbor has fulfilled the law. For this, you shall not commit adultery, shall not murder, shall not steal, shall not covet. And if there is any other commandment, it is summed up in this saying, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no wrong to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. That's just a natural way to read that. So you could back up then into chapter 12, read it naturally through verse 21, and then jump over to verse 8, and you wouldn't feel like you'd missed a beat. And some people have said, therefore, that these seven verses don't belong here, that Paul didn't write these here, they were put here for some other reason. There's no support for that. There's no textual support for that. These are the words of the Apostle Paul, and they're inspired by God, and they are troublesome. But we believe Paul wrote them, and by that we believe that God wrote them. We believe these are the words of God and that they are right where God intended to put them, right between verse 21 of chapter 12 and verse 8 of chapter 13. And it fits together like this. Evil is real. And we have to be trained as Christians to react to evil in a godly way. To react to evil even in a loving way. Not affirming the evil as good by our actions, but understanding that God, who is the ultimate good and righteous one, will one day bring about justice against all things evil. So Paul wants us to know that, and he wants us to practice that wherever you connect as a Christian with the reality of evil. Personally, when you connect with evil, as he instructed at the end of chapter 12, you can't repay evil for evil. You can't hold the grudge and seek revenge. In the workplace, when you come alongside evil, you can't react like evil. You have to react good among your associates, among your friends, even among your family, who might be, in fact, aligned with evil. You can't react in that way to them. And then, Paul says, think about this, there is the power of evil. There is evil, and then there's the concentrated power of evil. Evil has power. And power is as surely a part of these seven verses as good and evil are a part of these seven verses. If you look at again verse 1, every person is to be in subjection to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those which exist are established by God. And if we read on, the word authority or authorities is three more times, five times. That's the Greek word, this is important, exousia, E-X-O-U-S-I-A, our anglicized version of it. Here's the definition of exousia. This noun refers to the power or ability to do something, and also is used to describe the right to exercise power, authority, or rule. There is power connected to authority, which our Bible translates here as authority. But the word itself means power most directly. So you could read that verse this way. Every person is to be in subjection to the governing powers. For there is no power except by God. And the powers that exist are established by God. So do you see this? Power. You see it when you see it in your Bible. Authority. And you would see it most clearly as a Greek-speaking reader by the word exousia. It's the doing of something with force, with power. Therefore, verse 2 says, whoever resists the power has opposed the ordinance of God. So the appointment and the establishment of that power is God's. And if you resist or oppose that power, you will come up against not only the power of government, but the very power of God. This is what Paul says in these two verses. If you oppose that power, you are opposing God's power. If you go up against that power, you might in fact marshal enough forces, energy, events to overcome that power. But understand this, you will not and cannot overcome the power of God, and that is who you have opposed. So when you resist authority, it's God you're resisting. When you oppose the power of those who govern, you're opposing God's power. All of that's there in just two verses, two of the seven verses. And all of that, those two verses, watch carefully, clearly about power and resisting power and the source of power and the futility and recklessness of trying to oppose that power. In those two verses, that power has no relation to good or evil. It doesn't present that power as a good power, and it doesn't present that power as an evil power. It doesn't address this authority as a good authority and therefore act this way. It doesn't address it as an evil authority and therefore act another way. It's power from God's power, irrespective of good or evil. And a language study really helps us here. I don't know how often you're helped by language studies. I try not to force this on you too often. But sometimes, especially on texts that maybe are battlegrounds or difficult, and even if we understand them, hard to accept, it really helps us to understand the language. Two Greek words are used in the Bible and extra-biblical literature to speak of power, particularly of political power. The two words are closely connected, but they need to be distinguished if we would understand why there are two words and why, therefore, the Greek language uses two different words. The first word for power in the Greek is kratos. K-R-A-T-O-S. Kratos. You might refer to that by definition as the naked rule of power, just power in its essence. Kratos. That type of power can be legitimate or illegitimate by its qualifier. It's illegitimate power when it is applied to the devil, for instance, which is said to wield kratos, authority. He has, Hebrews 2:14 says, the very power of death, kratos. But he's going to lose that power when Jesus returns. His power, his kratos, will be taken away because it's illegitimate. It'll be cast into the lake of fire along with all the other illegitimacies that we could imagine. Now that word becomes useful in describing various kinds of government. For example, a democracy made up of two words. Demos, which simply means the crowd or the public assembly, and our first word, kratos, public power. Power in the hands of the people. Demo kratos. All right? Democracy. You recognize that, right? Plutocracy. Plutos means wealth. A plutocracy is power in the hands of the wealthy. So when you speak of kratos, you have to recognize that it can be legitimate or illegitimate, and it is defined by its context. It's defined by the one wielding it. Christians are under no obligation to obey a kratos that is illegitimate. You are under no obligation to obey the power of the devil. His kratos does not reign over you as a Christian. If a man approaches you with a gun and orders you to do something, he is wielding power. But he's wielding it illegitimately, and you are under no burden to do what he says. Now, you might do what he says because of his gun. But it's an illegitimate power that does not press on you one way or the other as it regards how you'll act to it. What you need in that scenario is somebody with legitimate power. Now, some of you in here would say, yeah, that's why I carry my own kratos. Nothing wrong with that. Others would say, I need the police. Another kratos, legitimate, to inform this position of evil that is seeking to rule over me. But there's a second word in the Greek that's used to speak of power, and particularly political power, and all other kinds of power. It's not kratos. I already gave you the word. It's exousia. That's the word Paul uses here. Exousia is a delegated power. It is a power whose authority rests in the one who delegated it. It's an authority, a power that rests in the one who appointed the exousia. Paul chooses to use that word here in this very important two verses to make explicitly clear to anyone reading it that the authority of the governing powers is not of the people, it is not of the wealthy, it is not of evil or illegitimate perspective. It is a delegated power by the powerful one, God Himself. It is by definition legitimate because it was delegated by God. Which is why Paul can write this and speak of this in two verses with no reference to good or evil. It is simply delegated power. Not power by the people, not power by the rich, not power by anyone or anything other than God Himself. Exousia. In fact, the only relation you can draw around this power that Paul pictures in these two verses concerning good or evil would be that it is from the good power of God. Because God is good. And God is not evil. God does good, not evil. And when He acts in power, then he is acting in goodness, but never alone, because you can never isolate his attributes, right? We've learned this from Paul already. So when he acts in power, it is a power of justice. It is a power of righteousness. It's a good power at its essence. All of that is right there in those first two verses as a power delegated by a good God. Which means these two verses are not constrained to the good people or the bad people. There's no relation to good or evil here as it regards the power. And there is no limitation given here in these two verses regarding the good or evil of the ones who also must submit to that power. In other words, this isn't good people submitting to good power. It isn't good people submitting to evil power. It isn't evil people who must submit to good power or evil people submitting to evil power. It's power and people submitting to it. And he also makes that clear in verse 1. Every person. Every person must react the same way to this power. Every person, not just good people, every person. Every person. This instruction then, the principles here, apply to everyone. They don't just apply to Christians. Every person must abide by this principle. It does not say every Christian is to be in subjection. It also doesn't say every Jew should be in subjection. By the way, there are those that have argued that what Paul really means here by every person is every Jew or Gentile. Every Jew or Christian. But he does not mean by it Gentile. Well, we studied Romans, you'd have to go back and blow the dust off over the last couple of years. And Paul makes clear when he's talking to Christians and Jews so that we don't confuse the Christians and the Jews. And he makes equally clear when he's talking to everybody. He's really clear when he says that God has shut the mouth of everyone by the law. He's really clear about that. And he's really clear here. This means exactly what it says. Every human being is bound by this principle. That means that the principle taught here is a universal principle. You've heard that before. A principle that applies to all people everywhere, anytime, all the time. It is not a principle applied in relation to the people in view, good subjects, bad subjects, frustrated subjects, poor subjects, rich subjects. No. And it's not in relation to the government itself that's in view, good government, bad government, indifferent government. No. All people everywhere submitting to this power delegated by God Himself. So the good power of God, who is the ultimate source of power, has granted power to govern. And those with that power govern over people, and they govern over all people. From that universal principle, we can make another universal principle. It is not and has never been appointed by God that people will be self-governed. Ever. Never. Not from the beginning, not in our past, not in our present, and it does not lie ahead of us in our future. Nowhere in the Bible will you see a principle of a self-governing people. Adam was not a self-governed individual, and he was perfect at the beginning. But from the beginning, he was a perfect person governed. Governed by God Himself, very clear in the giving of the law to Adam that said, "You shall not." That's God acting in power in accord with His authority over Adam. He did not tell Adam, "Have at it. It's yours." It was expected that Adam would submit to that power. And it was clear that a failure to submit to that power would expose Adam to horrible consequences. Death. So we understand that. Now here we are in Romans 13 and we have power again. Authority. With no relation to the good or the evil of that authority and no relation to the good or evil of the subjects over which the authority rules. This is not good power v. evil power. It's power and the exercise of power. It's authority and the exercise of authority over all people. No one lives outside that power. Nobody has the option to do that. And the naive, who imagine they can shirk the power, will only find themselves wholly submitted to the evil reign of the usurper of all of God's authority. And they will be under the power of Satan. Amen? There's no running from this. Every person, Paul says, must submit to power. To resist is not to avoid the power. It's only to run headlong into power. The most powerful power of all, God Himself. Which takes us to verse 3, where now we meet again good and evil. Rulers, this power, are not a cause of fear for good behavior, but for evil. Do you want to have no fear of this power, this authority? Do what is good, and you'll have praise from the same. For it is, this power, a minister of God to you for good. We have evil and good here, but not in relation to the government, not in relation to the power. This is evil and good now in relation to the people subjected to that power. Act good, get this. Act evil, get this. But when the power acts, it only acts in relation to one thing. God for good. It was appointed in its action by God for good. Then comes evil. But if you do what is evil, if you do what is evil, be afraid. For it does not bear the sword for nothing. It is a minister of God, repeated a second time. But notice now, with teeth in it. It's an avenger who brings wrath on the one who practices evil. So there's just two more verses. And it's a bit of a transition introduced by the word for in verse 3. For, or because of this, this is the reason given for every person in verse 1 submitting to the power of verse 2. This is the reason why every person must submit to the rulers. That's a new word, just another way of saying the same thing. It's power that rules. It's power that governs. Everyone needs to understand this power, this ruling or governing power, and your relation to it. My NASB says cause of fear, which would suggest there's three words there to be translated in the Greek, but there isn't. There's only one word in the Greek. And the word there is terror. You connect the power and the fear together. What you have is the reality of terror. This power is terrible. Terrible. The word there in the Greek is phobos. Something feared, from which we get our phobias of all manner of things. You say, now wait a minute, that's not what my Bible says. Look at it, Pastor Steve. For rulers are not a terror. Well, it says they're not a terror for good behavior, which necessarily means what? They're a terror for bad behavior. They are a terror for evil behavior. Government and rulers, in a universal principle that applies to everyone, everywhere, are a power, and they wield that power, and they are by that God-appointed terrorists. I could have put other words in there, but nothing quite as shocking. God-appointed terrorists. Paul is comfortable here. Comfortable equating power with terror. He works at it. He's very clear. They are a terror for evildoers. And he gets really clear in verse 4, if you do what is evil, be afraid of these terrorists. Because they bear the sword. They're not unarmed terrorists. They're armed terrorists. And then he calls them an avenger who brings wrath. He does not tiptoe around this idea of power-wielding terror. He's really comfortable with it. Acting in power delegated, wielding a sword authorized, they bring avenging wrath. It's not a pretty picture of government. Paul does not have this crazy, high, everybody's wonderful view of government, even as he wrestles out these principles. He has a frightening picture of government. But he also understands it's God's servant. This is God's deacon. It's his minister. And it acts as God's minister in a terrible way against wrongdoers, against evil, and it acts in a good way toward those who do good. Nothing to fear if you do good. There's no terror there. Really. Well, before we get to that, I think you see how fraught with really, really dangerous potential this whole idea is, right? Human authorities wielding this kind of power. How that kind of power to do terrible and good placed into the hands of an earthly government might produce horrendous outcomes. But we saw last week, Paul's not naive to that. God isn't naive to that. But he is nonetheless committed to that. And it forces us to think about this. And Paul's already forced us to think about it, I don't know, a couple years ago, when we were in Romans 9. If you'll turn back to Romans 9, Paul gives us one example of an evil, terrible, power-wielding government established by God, appointed by God. The example is Pharaoh. And the ones being oppressed are the Jews. There was a Pharaoh who rose in Egypt who did not know Joseph. The book of Exodus teaches us. He worked the Jews as slaves. He beat them down. He terrorized them. And then when Moses, one of those Jews, came on behalf of God, he resisted him with arrogant defiance. And even when his nation was plagued, culminating in the death ultimately of all the firstborn of that country, he remained defiant. In the end, he and his armies would be destroyed by drowning in the Red Sea. But as evil as this man was, he was put in that position by God. Paul clearly says it, Romans 9:17. He quotes God talking to Pharaoh. I raised you up for this. I raised you up that I might display my power and that my name might be proclaimed in all the earth. In other words, God raised Pharaoh up that he might display his avenging wrath through Pharaoh. It's hard for us to put our heads around that, especially when we read further, whether Exodus or here in Romans 9, that God was active in his rebellion by hardening his heart, intensifying the burden placed on the people that now they would be forced to make bricks without straw. You could look to the Old Testament example of Nebuchadnezzar. What an arrogant, wicked man. Thought he was superior to God. Conquered God's people and God's city. Destroyed the temple and carried them all off to Babylon. The first four chapters of Daniel record the contention between Nebuchadnezzar and God. The battle, as it were, for power, a battle Nebuchadnezzar didn't realize was already lost. Look at Daniel 4. Take a minute and find that. Three times in this chapter, you will read, take verse 17 as an example, the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind. Verse 25, the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whomever he wishes. Verse 32, the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind and bestows it on whoever he wishes. The first time it was when Nebuchadnezzar heard those words in a dream. Then the second time was Daniel reciting those words to him as the very words of God. And then the third time, Nebuchadnezzar heard them from heaven, when God ushered in his judgment and drove him mad. And then Nebuchadnezzar responds verse 34, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raise my eyes toward heaven and my reason returned to me and I bless the Most High and praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say to him, what hast thou done? Wicked ruler, appointed by God to do unimaginable things in the sieging of Jerusalem that starved out thousands, and in his personal rebellion against the Most High God. And then we have Jesus before Pilate. Same thing, right, guys? You would have no power over me, Jesus said. Exousia. You wouldn't enjoy this delegated authority if it hadn't been given to you. Pilate had authority. and he wielded it in a horrible way, more unimaginable than Nebuchadnezzar's himself. Because with his power, he convicted the Son of God to be executed. So how are we to understand this? Well, we got lots of questions still to answer. I'm out of time. But these first four verses hinge on this thing. God, the all-powerful, all-good God, has appointed and delegated authority to act on his behalf. And you can know this as his child. He will always have them act for your good. And maybe you could go back in your mind and visit our little Just Thinking this morning. When you understand that there are no bad days for a Christian. Y'all can go talk about this at lunch. It also means this. There are no bad rulers. Not for a Christian. They do what they do at God's behest. And whatever they do is for your good. That's where faith enters in. That's where we trust God. Always submit. That's next week. All right, you're dismissed. Thanks.
You've been listening to Pastor and Bible teacher Steve Wilson of Grace Community Church in Bowling Green, Kentucky. We trust you've been encouraged and challenged by this message. If you would like to listen to more of Pastor Wilson's messages or obtain more information on the ministry of Grace Community Church, you can go to our website at gccbg.com. That's gccbg.com.